Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Wednesday, November 6, WAMC will be hosting a post-election panel at the Linda from 9 to noon. Tickets are still available, and you can go to WAMC.org to find more information. On Roundtable Panel The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, October 30th, Joe was joined by Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, and Albany Law School professor Sarah Rogerson.
Vice President Harris delivered her closing campaign argument. A spot where she did it was chosen to draw a sharp contrast with Trump. It is where he spoke on January 6, 2021, and told people to follow him after saying on Truth Social that it was going to be wild. She used the setting to make the distinction between her vision of the country and his. It came just 2 days after Donald Trump made his closing argument in New York City at Madison Square Garden. She could have given the major speech in any of the seven battleground states, and if she wanted to deliver it in the nation's capital, she had her pick of historic locations. But Harris specifically chose the Ellipse, just south of the White House, the exact spot where Trump attended the infamous January 6th rally that launched hundreds of his supporters on a violent attack at the Capitol building in an attempt to overturn his election loss. And with the White House as a dramatic backdrop, she used the setting to make a sharp distinction between her vision for the country and the former president's. Donald Trump has spent a decade trying to keep the American people divided and afraid of each other. That's who he is. But America, I am here tonight to say that's not who we are, Harris said. America, we know what Donald Trump has in mind, more chaos, more division, and politics that help those at the very top and hurt everyone else. I offer a different path, and I ask for your vote. Even with Trump top of mind, Harris's challenge was to draw a contrast without ceding control of the conversation of the former president. After Hillary Clinton's loss in 2016, some Democrats thought she focused too much on Trump and the campaign's home stretch. And just a few days ago, Future Forward, a major super PAC supporting Harris, raised concerns that zeroing in on Trump's character was not the most effective closing message. So with that, we go over to our panelists. And Bob, what do you think?
Well, I mean, it's kind of hard not to raise the character issue. It is all about character. I mean, you can't see a starker difference between these two candidates, which for some of us listening, I'm sure it's hard to understand some of the current polling, because when you listen to one candidate who's making outlandish attacks, is supporting speakers on his stage that are frankly vile. You know, I'm not sure I agree with the position that we should be ignoring Donald Trump's character. I thought her speech was exceptional. It was presidential. I thought it continued to draw a sharp line in my mind between the two candidates. So she did what I think needed to be done. I think she needs to continue to push. I know she's in three swing states today, and I think she continues to need to outwork Trump. Joe, I'm going to go on record right now. I think Harris wins, and I think she wins by a larger margin than polls are talking about, but it's all about the ground game. It's all about people getting out to vote. It's all about taking time to talk to our neighbors and family members and remind them what's at stake. But at the same point, I think there are enough trends that I'm seeing that I feel that with more hard work and a sprint to the finish, that things are going to be okay.
Yeah, I think these speeches are really meant to get the base motivated to get out the vote on Election Day. Obama won because he had a historically unprecedented, savvy, specific field game. This is different because Trump has a savvy, I wouldn't call it sophisticated, but an insider view of how to disrupt this election. Right. So the ground game is going to have to be smarter and savvier than it was certainly last election cycle and back when Obama was elected. I understand the critique about character. The swing voters don't care because we're so calloused as a country at this point about our leadership that it's about the positionality. And it's about your personal, I don't want to call it agenda, because a lot of times it's like needs, right? Like, how much are groceries going to cost me this week? Can I take my kids to Disney World? Can I buy a truck? Can I, afford to send my kids to summer camp so that I can have an undisrupted work schedule in the summer, because we woefully undervalue and underfund care work, and it hurts our economy primarily for women. So men still run this country, and the things that men care about still run this country. And so character of leadership is not one of those things that many men in leadership care about. And Donald Trump did a lot of that, but Elon Musk isn't helping things, and many, many other men behind them. So I appreciate all of the work that other men are doing to dispel rumors and different things. But all you have to do is look at the Proposition 1 chaos to see how easily distractible people are from the truth and reality and words on a page. So these speeches are great for getting people excited who are already excited about the platforms or positions that people are rolling out. But they're not. I agree that in order to capture more moderate voters, there's a more nuanced message that happens in other spaces, quite frankly.
Sarah, for the listeners who aren't from New York, can you talk a little bit about Proposition 1 and what's going on?
Yeah, so there's a misinformation campaign that's very well, I wouldn't say very well organized. Some of the signs are in Comic Sans font, for example, which really isn't the one you pick when you're trying to persuade people that your message is serious. But
yeah, when you have the word comic.
I mean, the Times Union has been doing a good job of trying to combat misinformation, but it's about reproductive freedom and making that creating New York State constitutional protections for reproductive rights, which has been turned into all kinds of things: anti-immigrant messaging, trans messaging under the guise of parental choice and saving girls sports and keeping illegal immigrants, quote unquote, I don't use that term, undocumented, but that's what's on the signs, from getting rights. So if you look at the text of the proposition and what it actually does, and if you read the news and pay attention to explainers that people are putting out into the public, it's not what the misinformation campaign is making it out to be. But people are having to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars to combat that misinformation and that contortion of facts around one ballot proposition in one state. It's happening everywhere.
It is happening everywhere. And some, I mean, have multiple, I mean, so many ballot propositions that the voters are going to, you know, it's going to be very confusing for them as they try to work their way through these various propositions and figure it out and what's right and what's wrong for them.
It's on the level of like they're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats.
Right.
It's at that level of misinformation.
Correct.
And vitriol.
Heather Mulligan joins us. She is the CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Sorry I'm late.
That's all right.
We knew the first time.
You reported in and told us exactly when you were going to be here, and you're exactly here when you said you would. So we're thrilled that you're here, and thank you very much. I think you see where we are in the conversation. Anything you'd like to add?
I do, and I was listening on the way in, which I usually do, and just so people know, the reason I'm late is because my dogs are getting a bath this morning, and I had to drop them off. Something I forgot as I was planning my morning, and then I realized at the last second, so that was fun.
Pet bathing, very important.
Yeah, they smell pretty bad right now. I'm not going to lie.
Dogs on the farm.
Yeah.
So it's safe to visit your house again, is what you're saying.
It is right now. Yeah, they're not home right now. So, no, my dogs are very friendly, but they also really enjoy the outdoors and they like to roll around. And, you know, dogs are dogs. But I was listening and, you know, on the closing argument piece, I think I heard a lot of what Sarah had to say. And I think it's right that the closing arguments are for the base. They're not necessarily to try and convince last-minute swing voters. If they were, they would be in swing states, right? They'd be in the swing states. But I don't think that either closing argument is going to make a difference, even though there is a tremendous gaffe, obviously, at Madison Square Garden. I don't know how they did not – someone on the campaign staff should be fired for allowing that comedian to come on. I mean, this is not a joke that was out of the blue. It was something he practiced before. So they would have had knowledge. They're definitely trying to walk away from it and roll it back. But they're just trying to keep their base, and she's trying to keep hers.
It was a love fest, Heather.
It was a love fest. That's what I hear. I do not agree, though, that Harris is going to win a landslide. I think if she wins, it will be by the smallest, tiniest of margins. I have a very good friend who is on the road right now, who's a reporter for a very prominent publication, certainly not a right-leaning publication by any stretch of the imagination. This friend is not right-leaning. And the assessment from Wisconsin and Michigan, the blue wall states, is that she's not going to win either state, and she's going to lose those states by a significant margin, which – so – you know, maybe the comments at the Love Fest will influence the outcome in Pennsylvania, which certainly is going to be very important. But I am very concerned. In fact, the assessment from this reporter was not only was his prediction was not that that Harris was going to win by a squeaker. His prediction was that Trump was going to win by a lot. And that is from someone who's on the ground in the swing states. So I also have been in conversations with the heads of state chambers from other states. We talk all the time, and we do, you know, basically straw polls on who do we think is going to win. And the most she did early on have the vote, but she does not anymore. So sorry to be so sobering.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's going to be a landslide. I'm not saying that she's going to get 80% of the vote, but I think that she's going to do better in the swing states than what's being published right now.
Anything anyone would want to say about where we left the conversation before the break?
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple more things to toss out. One, Biden just needs to be quiet and, you know, let things go. Don't give any bulletin board material that will take the wind out of Trump's team's sort of self-inflicted wounds. And Heather, I think your point about what happened in Madison Square Garden, that was all self-inflicted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also think that Harris should be prepared to declare victory early, because I think that's what Trump is going to try to do. I mean, if you start to look at some of the statements that are coming out about elections in Pennsylvania right now, it's the classic playbook of trying to say that it's corrupt, so that there's cheating going on when there is no evidence of that. And frankly, I think that the DOJ needs to be prepared to do its job.
Yeah, I don't know what the margin of votes is going to look like in Pennsylvania, but under their ballot rules, they can't start opening the mail-in ballots until Election Day, right. Unlike Florida, which they open them as they receive them. So there's, you know, that's going to cause delay. And if there are, and I again, don't know what the numbers look like in terms of the number of mail-in ballots in Pennsylvania, but if it's close and there's enough ballots, you know, that you're within the margins, then it could significantly delay calling of that state.
Right.
Yeah, especially where the smaller rural counties, which traditionally vote red, are going to come in sooner than some of the more urban areas and certainly the mail-in votes.
Yeah, that's strategic too.
Right.
Claim the lead early.
Yep. And then claim that they were robbed. That's so. Yep.
So I was listening to Michael Smirkanish, who's a POTUS. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a man in the middle, I guess. And he's in Pennsylvania, and he said that a lot of the I don't know if it was him or a guest said a lot of the problems in counting the urban areas in Pennsylvania have been resolved. Like they have a new methodology, they have a way to make sure that there's not huge delays in the counting of their urban votes. So I'm not sure what that, you know, what that system
specifically
is.
Specifically in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
They have worked very hard on the system in Philadelphia to make that a more rapid system.
Yes.
But it's the outlying counties, the suburban counties, and quite frankly, the blue suburban
right.
counties that of not only Philadelphia, but also of Pittsburgh. Harrisburg.
Yeah. In Erie, too.
And Erie, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's go to some letters. We go to Linda. So what exactly does Proposition 1 do? I agree there's a lot of information out there about its intent and how it will affect others. However, when I read the text of the proposition, it's really not making a lot of sense to me. If you can water it down to the point where it can be understood easily, I would appreciate that. Otherwise, I have no idea what it says. And I'm going to just skip the proposition altogether. Too ridiculous to even bother with.
Well, the text reads, adds anti-discrimination provisions to state constitution, period. Covers ethnicity, national origin, age, disability, and sex, including sexual orientation, gender identity, and pregnancy, period. Also covers reproductive health care and autonomy, period. That's what it reads. There is a website now that I just stumbled on this morning, but it does contain helpful information. It's called whatisnyprop1.org, the number one. And it boils it down. It says, get the facts. And under what does Prop 1 do, it says Prop 1 will ensure our reproductive rights and fundamental freedoms, including abortion, are protected from government interference. Keeping the power with New Yorkers and not politicians permanently. It also protects New Yorkers from government discrimination because no New Yorker should be taken advantage of by those in power. And the reason why they can claim that is because it would amend the state constitution, which is way more powerful than any legislative item in the state of New York. So it doesn't change the law. It changes the way that the rights are protected.
Anybody want to add anything to that?
Sure. I mean, I think just to elaborate, it means that a future legislature could not alter by passing a bill and even having it signed into law rights in violation or in conflict with what is in the Constitution. The Constitution, anything that provides greater protection under the Constitution can't be undermined by state level legislation. And certainly under federal law, the state has the ability to afford greater rights to its citizen than the federal government. It cannot provide lesser rights. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the ideal thing would be the protection of reproductive rights in the U.S. Constitution, because then no state could undermine them. And that is sort of like the whole problem that starts with the Roe decision and keeps going, right? It didn't start there. There's a whole lot of other cases that relate to what is a protected right under the U.S. Constitution. But so this would provide it at the state level. And I know there's an argument that the state has already enshrined Roe versus Wade in statute, and I think maybe even in the Constitution already. But this goes beyond that in terms of anti-discrimination.
That was Heather Mulligan on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, October 30th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, October 31st, Joe was joined by the Ulster County Comptroller and the former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, Senior Fellow, Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
Here we go. The Justice Department has sent out hundreds of monitors for decades to just make sure that the elections are run in a proper and safe and valid way. Republican leaders in some states have begun denying them entry to polling sites. They're blocking those Justice Department election monitors. The U.S. government has regularly dispatched hundreds of monitors to voting locations in blue and red and swing states, aiming to protect ballot access, discourage improper partisan influence, and act as a moderating force on political campaigns. The Justice Department's ability to monitor local jurisdictions for voting rights irregularities on Election Day, already curtailed by the Supreme Court, is facing a new hurdle: opposition from Republicans who are seeking to block those authorities from polling sites. While the Justice Department has the legal right to request access to polling sites, inflamed partisanship and ideological extremism have contributed to greater resistance to such activities in some GOP-controlled states. Those states have attempted to politicize the process and cast federal monitors as partisans from the Biden administration who cannot be trusted. Republican leaders in Missouri and Florida, which flatly banned federal monitors in 2022 midterm elections, said in recent interviews that their positions have not changed and that justice officials likely would be rebuffed again if they request access to voting locations for Tuesday's presidential election. Missouri Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft accused the Justice Department of using monitors to punish conservative states that have tightened voter identification laws and adopted policies the Biden administration opposes. Jim, let's begin with you.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here. I think maybe one starting point is just it's a reminder, this tension between Department of Justice monitors and the states, that and how we run our national elections, that it's not one national election, but it's run by states and localities, and they have all kinds of, or they give themselves all kinds of discretion as to how they're going to run the elections, and being able to rebuff somebody from the federal government that is there in a nonpartisan way to monitor, you know, just the operation of the elections is a sign of, you know, a much deeper problem about how everything has become so toxic And every institution is seen in with such great suspicion that you know, it does not augur well going forward. I would also say that a couple other things. So you had mentioned, Joe, that I've done these monitoring missions internationally.
Correct.
And I've done them not always with, but mostly with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. It's a mouthful, the OSCE. The U.S. is a member state of the OSCE, which is how I've been able to go on these missions as part of the U.S. delegations. But that also means that OSCE election monitors have come to the United States in past elections and for this election. I don't think they have a very large monitoring mission, but they do have monitors around the country. And in the past, they have also been denied access in some states, even though we have a treaty obligation to allow them to come. They are completely nonpartisan. They're not even Americans. They are here with diplomatic credentials to be able to observe the elections, to report on them, and to offer a written report at the end of it all with what went right, what went wrong, lessons to be learned, not just for the United States, but for other member states of the 57 member states of this organization. I also will be working the polls here in Albany County on election day, because I figured if I can work on elections in Kosovo and Ukraine and Azerbaijan, I should be able to do it in Albany County as well. And so I am.
I would agree with that, by the way.
Yeah, and I worked in the both of the primaries earlier this year. You know, and I'm very impressed with my fellow poll workers. They're very professional, very committed. It's an extremely long day, and people take it seriously, and they do a good job. In the run-up to this election, I was given the opportunity from the Albany County Sheriff's Department to take a course on threat assessment and safety in general. And this is the kind of course, almost the exact kind of course I took through the U.S. Embassy when I was in Egypt during revolution times. And so to take such a course, which has never been offered before for poll workers, as far as I know, and that it's needed, I think also says a lot about the tensions that we already see happening in some of the early voting places around the country, and that, you know, things are just on a knife's edge, and the polling locations are likely to be a place where we really see people act out. I hope not, but I think that people are bracing for impact.
March.
So I'm actually going to be a poll monitor over the weekend for early voting. I was recruited because I'm an attorney to do that. And I have to do a training that hasn't been completed yet. And I look forward to seeing whether there's a threat assessment component. I hope that there is. There really should be. But to me, the way that we talk about poll monitoring has really changed. And I think if you look at, you know, DOJ's responsibility and what they were doing with the Voting Rights Act and their deployment of voting monitors really was to make sure that everyone who is allowed to vote is empowered to do so, right? It's about making sure people are allowed to get to the polls. What we see now in this shift to local and political and partisan poll monitoring is barring people from voting. So it's not the same message, and it's not the same purpose. So poll monitoring has really changed in the United States, I feel like, over the last 10 years. And I think it's a result of, you know, the rhetoric against, you know, immigrants from other countries or people who are undocumented and, you know, lies told about numbers of undocumented people voting. But the monitoring has shifted from making sure that everybody who should have a right to vote gets to the actual polls and is able to do so to keeping people out of voting. And we see things like the Supreme Court decision, you know, just this week, right, purging the voter rolls in Virginia. So it's a really pervasive issue whether or not people are allowed to get to the polls. And then you see, you know, people like Sarah Huckabee Sanders and her representative, you know, this week saying that it would be, you know, a violation of the law for DOJ to come into these polling facilities. That is a definite change in sentiment. And, you know, I haven't done the research to know if there's even a legal basis for that argument, but it's hugely concerning.
And obviously that comes to trust of government and trust and then and making it partisan as opposed to bipartisan, and that they're there for the integrity of the election. I guess, and I want to hear from Judy. But my main question too. Well, let's hear from Judy, and then I'm going to ask just this main question, okay. Which is, okay, but if not this, then what? You know, then what do you do as the next step? Judy.
Well, the Trump campaign has made a big deal out of ginning up their base to be on the lookout for even the slightest hint of irregularities. And so those are piling up on social media at an amazing pace. I should tell people that Election Day, there are thousands, millions of machines out there. Some of them are not going to work correctly. This is what campaign or election officials deal with every year. This is what we report on every year. A little bit of dysfunction is acceptable, but what we're going to see is really an aggressive challenge to a lot of people trying to vote.
And so if we don't have this, then what are the protections? What are the protections for the vote? What are the protections that are there to say, okay, everything's going to go the way it quote unquote should go?
Well, my feeling, Joe, is we need to enact the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. We need to repair the damage that was done in a 2013 decisions, kind of stripping, you know, portions of the Voting Rights Act as it stands. And we need legislation to shore this up. I don't know if we're going to get it. That feels like a really far stretch, but I'm really hoping that we can see that change.
I saw a story the other day, 2 days ago, about the number of people seeking advice from their mental health professionals and having to deal with the election because they can't eat, they can't sleep, they're so upset. So I took the article and I forwarded it to my therapist, and I said, does this track with you? And she said, oh my God, I'm busier than I've ever been before. And I thought, wow, that is, you know, that's really something. So we'll talk about that a little bit. So that's sort of superstition on steroids. We're like beyond that of where it affects your daily life. John writes to us and says, those states that are blocking federal and international election monitors, I want to know, what are they hiding? And I want to know why mainstream media isn't blaring, here you go, Judy, blaring that question out of the airwaves. This country's attitude towards elections, the now widespread belief that one person can't solve everything, as if Congress doesn't exist, and this we won, you lost, now shut up and do what we say understanding of democracy shows that the republic is lost, and democracy in this country is in the ICU on life support and dead from the waist down.
Wow.
It's a very vivid email from John this morning.
Frankenstein.
Yes.
What about from the heart down?
Yeah, well, that's also, yes, mangled. And but that question of, it does, I mean, this sort of goes in tandem with what I was asking before the break, which is, so, yeah, if you're not going to let them in, then what is being hidden on their side, other sides. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, if one side has been saying for months, if not years, that there's massive fraud going on, and at the same time saying we don't want to have election monitors, International Department of Justice, but we do want to have our own monitors who come in, as March was saying, with, you know, a real partisan intent. That doesn't seem to match up to the idea that we want to stamp out fraud and we want to make sure that the elections are free, as free and fair as possible. I can tell you that for the international monitors, you have to go through really extensive training before you are even selected, and the vetting process is pretty serious. And then when you end up in the country, you also do very intensive briefings and trainings, and you sign all kinds of forms about the code of conduct that you're going to follow. And I'm pretty sure that it's not happening for the people who are being sent out on these partisan missions, which I think have less to do with monitoring, less to do with free and fair elections, and a lot more to do with intimidation.
Let's go to this letter, and this is from Pamela. I had the pleasure of attending a very interesting program in HVCC on Tuesday and very much appreciate Jim Ketterer's expertise.
Oh.
What was that program?
That was very similar to what we're talking about. The long title of it was What I've Learned About American Democracy by Observing Elections Overseas.
Oh, very cool. He said, Pamela says, it sounds to me as though with so many partisans looking for quote-unquote irregularities, they may actually create irregularities. Perhaps Mr. Ketterer and the panel could comment on that.
Yeah, I think that flows into what I was just saying.
Yeah.
That, yeah, I mean, there. I mean, March, you said you're undergoing training as well. And in addition to, you know, the safety kind of training, but just, you know, what to look for and how to also behave, you know, in a way that is not going to be intimidating and is not going to be partisan. I mean, that has to be at the core of it. And if it's not there, something else is going on.
I mean, again, I think, you know, I'm coming from the perspective of wanting to make sure that everybody who has a right to vote actually gets to cast their ballot. And I am concerned there will be other people there whose goal is to stop people from voting. And that's not what you want to go in as an election monitor with your mindset. And I also think that there's some concern about people electioneering right in the polling place. You know, wearing your MAGA hat or wearing your pins or your shirts or whatever is not really appropriate in that location. And then when you try to note that and ask somebody to change, are they going to respect that or are they going to come back at you in a very difficult and challenging way? So, it's going to be very interesting.
Although I am on election day tempted to wear my Alfred E. Newman for President pin, but probably shouldn't.
Satire is allowed.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially if you've already voted, it's probably okay. Judy?
You know, a few years ago there was an issue about taking selfies in the voting booth or selfies in the election issue area. I wonder whether or not people taking photographs is going to be an issue as well. And what exactly does a federal monitor do? Do they stand behind the table and watch people register? And what are the rules or what are their actual duties?
It's a great question. And it's just, I wonder how, I guess I internalize it and think about, so I voted first day at the county center in Washington County and I walked in and I knew everybody. And I don't know, we go through the regularities, and I understand this in large areas where you don't know, and it's much different. But there is that, like, that local connection where there are people who are there to, well, and I assume this will be the case for you, March. I mean, where you're going to know a lot of the people who
I
are
will,
walking
but
in.
New Paltz is a college town, so there'll be young people that I don't know.
Right. But I mean, there are people there who, like, it's a mix, right? I mean, it's a mix of people there who are generally there to assist in the voting, and there's somebody in charge of the crock pot.
That's
but
right.
I can tell you what the international monitors do, and it's probably the same with the Department of Justice. I mean, you go in knowing what the process is supposed to be. That's part of the briefings that you've had. Okay, here's how it's supposed to work in a polling station, whether it's in Albany or New Paltz or Azerbaijan or what have you. This is exactly the procedures that the people working there should be following. And you go in and you spend some time, ideally, if you're going to multiple polling stations, at least a half an hour, if not 45 minutes, and you see, are they following the process? Are there any violations of the laws that apply in that locality? And you're seeing, are the signatures matching? Are the identifications being done in a way that follows the regulations, et cetera? So, you know, you're not making it up. You're not just kind of deciding, oh, this feels right to me or not. You have a very kind of specific technical task ahead of you. And you're given access to be able to do that, but you're not there to solve problems. If there's any problems and somebody says, oh, this person said this, or as an observer, you have no role in that.
It's an important point.
And so that's at least the international take on it.
So Tish James, the Attorney General, has opened like a voting rights hotline. So if you have a problem, look for that. If you don't have a voting, you know, a poll monitor there to help you. But in Ulster County, we actually had a situation where there was signage hanging at a polling place that said you have to have a picture ID to vote. And that is under investigation right now. It was taken down. That's not true.
That was March Gallagher on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, October 31st. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, November 1st, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman, and Siena College professor of economics Aaron Pasitti. We are also joined by Siena College economics majors from the Federal Reserve Challenge course Joseph Reed, Jacob Snell, Sydney Tovar, and Madeline Trotta.
Aaron, we just have about 3 or 4 minutes before the break, and I'm just hoping that you can give us a sense of there was a pretty good story on Marketplace coming into our program about the new jobs report, the unemployment report, and what it said is that things are cooling, but there were some real, you know, catastrophic reasons as to why that was the case. If you can give us a summation, and then when we come back, we'll get into some depth.
Sure. So in October, the economy only added 12,000 jobs. That was down from the 254,000 in September. So a major slowdown. Part of that was driven by the strike at Boeing, which cost 41,000 workers, and then the as-yet undetermined effect of the hurricanes that hit the southeast. So the unemployment rate stayed constant at 4.1% from September to October. Wage growth remained at 4%. So looking at the big picture without getting in the weeds, we have the strongest labor market we have had in over 50 years, with the unemployment rate being below 4%. For, you know, 3+ years. Wage growth has been exceeding inflation for the past year, so workers are starting to see their paychecks catch up with the rising cost of living. However, despite all of that good news about, you know, the abundance of jobs, workers being able to switch jobs and get higher wages, this is the last employment report before the election, and it's certainly something that the Trump campaign can pounce on and say, the people are getting nervous with Harris or whatever, and she's ruining the economy. It's all misguided. The biggest picture is, sure, there was a slowdown in job growth. A lot of that's the Boeing strike and the hurricane. Still remains the strongest labor market with exceptionally strong wage gains, the strongest labor market in 50 years.
And especially given the month, but the next month's numbers would be expected, barring any catastrophe, like an election, that things will be better.
Yeah. No, this is clearly an aberration. And I honestly think the September report was an aberration on the upside, where it came in stronger than people expected. This one was lower. What we're seeing is kind of this return to normal, where we're looking at adding 150 to 200,000 jobs per month.
The job numbers that were released just less than an hour ago, and where we are there. Mark, anything you would like to say on that?
I agree with Aaron that job figures month to month are bounce around. the general trend in this economy is, frankly, the envy of the world. I mean, we now comprise about half of the G7's GDP, and in 1990, we were 40% of that. They would all love to be us, would be the simple answer to that. But that doesn't get to why people see it, the economy, as such a pressing issue for them. I do think there are a number of explanations for that. We've talked to that on this panel. Part of it is partisan. Frankly, your view on the economy is highly dependent upon the person you see in the White House. The fact that most boats have risen in the United States over time because of globalism doesn't mean that all boats have risen. We've certainly left some areas behind. And industrialists and politicians are to blame for leaving those areas behind and not thinking about the fact that what's good for the economy as a whole isn't necessarily good for every geographic area within the economy. I also think people miss that there is a permanent unease that will persist in the psyche of folks who've lived through the COVID pandemic, just as there was, frankly, for people who lived through the Great Depression or the Great Depression and or World War II. I also think you're missing the fact that people, particularly men in this country, who do not have a college education, are afraid because their relative wages have suffered in the wake of globalization. And they see they and their friends struggling ever more. And when Kamala Harris says, we're not going back, they kind of say, hey, maybe I'd rather, in terms of the way the country looked from an industrial standpoint historically. So I think you can pretty readily square the circle if you think about it carefully. The fact that we have an economy that's the envy of the world and basically is doing as well as it could be. There's also, by the way, the issue of sticker shock on inflation. The economists use a strange term. Inflation is the rate of change in prices. But as I hear from my cashier and I ask them every time I go to the grocery store, do people still complain? They say yes. They're still repeatedly uncomfortable with how much they pay. I also think there's one factor, and I'll give an assignment to the young folks in the room. I also think we talked about the fact that wages have sort of, quote unquote, caught up. I don't think that's true. If you look at lower income people, because rent is a higher proportion of their income, they actually haven't caught up. I also think if you sort of envision what happened over the last few years as two runners on a track, one being cost and one being wages. For 2 years, the cost runner got a big boost from inflation, and the wage runner has been catching up. But I don't think, particularly if you look at median and lower income folks in this country, I don't think the wage runner has caught up, and the investments that are available to folks in those middle income or lower income haven't sort of made their whole wealth situation better. I still think they're behind. So it's dangerous to dismiss. It's dangerous to say, oh, the economy's great, everybody should be happy. And there are definitely reasons why, particularly amongst male working class folks in this country, they're not happy. And you're seeing that play out in this election.
Teresa?
I think what when Vice President Harris says we're not going back, she means we're not going back to Trump. And not that we're not going back to the 50s or 60s, and maybe we don't need to go back there either, but she's not going back to Trump. And I think there has been this myth around Trump and because of the disinformation campaign that he wages and that Fox echoes for him and so many of the other Republicans, that his was a great economy and that he's a great business person. Well, he is, you know, by all measures, not a great business person. He was given $400 million from his father. You know, we know the story. Six bankruptcies. And, you know, he had all these Trump University with scammed students. He historically has not paid his workers. He has not paid his contractors. He had the scam Trump Foundation, you know, in so many different ways. The parts of The Apprentice, which is the myth that's been created around him, so much of that was fabricated. So from a business person's perspective, he's not the strong business person that he's created. But he didn't create a strong economy when he's president. The first year was the Obama economy. The next 2 years was really focused on the tax cuts, which were skewed to the very wealthy and created enormous deficits. and probably increase the income inequality in this country. And then you have to look to where he wants to go in the future. And economists, and you folks can talk to that, say that it's just not a good economic pathway. So I think that we also have to look at a lot, as Aaron, you laid out, the range of good indicators in the economy. And people are feeling better in the sense that they're traveling more, they're spending more, those kinds of things. Now, they are running up their credit cards, which is not good. But what the vice president has also said is, yes, we have things are getting better, but we have more work to do, which is to your point, Mark, which is, okay, why do things cost so much? And how can we get those prices down? And how can we increase the housing, improve housing? And those are the things, those the to-dos that need to be worked on.
I think it's so I think Mark brings up a good point in that lower income households who spend an overwhelming majority of their income on housing and groceries have really felt the pinch because those have been the two major sources of inflation. Yes, Harris said we're not going back. And for, you know, workers who had factory jobs, workers without college degrees have suffered substantial income losses. Harris is also proposing a path forward, right? 21st century manufacturing, subsidizing strategic industries like semiconductors and green energy. But it's...
The Biden administration made some great strides in bringing back manufacturing.
But I think the issue is not to bring prices down. To do that would require double-digit unemployment for 5+ years. You would have to create a depression to bring prices down because you would have to diminish purchasing power so much that businesses would just lower and lower prices to the point where they're barely earning a profit. So it's bad for businesses, bad for workers. The solution isn't to drive prices down, it's to bring incomes up.
Right.
So the Harris campaign really hasn't offered a lot in that realm. There's been, you know, she hasn't mentioned anything about, you know, raising the minimum wage to a living wage. There's been some token gestures to, you know, more pro-labor law that would make it easier for workers to unionize, but very scarce on details of that.
The PRO Act.
Yeah, I'm not saying that she's been entirely silent on this, but the solution is to raise incomes. And what continuing what the Biden administration did with the CHIPS Act, the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, keeping up that type of industrial policy, that's pro-growth policy, where it generates growth so that the additional revenue the economy receives from that growth can essentially pay for that investment. It's not government spending, it's government investment.
And do you think investing in small business does that also?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Anything but tax cuts for Fortune 500 companies will create growth, and that's what Trump is promising to do, more or less.
All right, let's go to Sienna's Finest and hear from anyone want to weigh in on this particular subject of these numbers or thoughts?
Yeah, I can.
Okay, go ahead, Jacob.
For me, when I'm looking at economic numbers and like worries for like when I'm graduating from college, the first thing that like jumps out to me is like the cost of housing. Like,
yes.
In my town, like, you know, rent could go for like $800, like, pre-pandemic, and now we're looking at like $1,500 a month. And if I want to move to a city, once I graduate, I'm looking at like jobs in like Boston, New York, D.C. I'm looking at like $2,500 a month.
You don't want to stay at home?
If my parents are listening, no offense to you guys.
Joke. Yeah.
But ideally, you know, I get to move out, see more of the U.S. But yeah. I mean, I think rent and housing costs are a very big thing that are like holding people back. And at least like Kamala Harris has like plans like for housing that like, because housing is like a very important thing to me. Like when I'm looking at who I'm going to vote for, like when, like between the two, I see like hard concrete plans laid out from one side and like not the other.
That will impact you directly.
That will impact me directly.
As
yes.
you and you said you were a senior, so you're,
yes.
you're. I mean, this is an immediate thing for you.
Yeah.
This will come,
mm-hmm.
especially if you go beyond. Anybody else want to? Yeah, go ahead.
I'll add to that. I think one of my major things looking for a job, as I said, I have no idea what I want to do.
Yeah.
But looking for a job, I've applied a lot. I think one of my major things is looking at housing costs in the area. I mean, since I've been a little kid, my parents have rented, so I've seen rent go up just by myself, like looking at them. I mean, my area is like close to $2,500 a month now for three bedroom, one, like two bathrooms. So it's right. It's getting pretty high. Housing prices in my area are like close to $500,000 for a, like a regular single family home. So, I mean, it's definitely getting a lot more expensive up here. I mean, I was looking just in Texas just to see what houses are, and you can get a five bedroom, like three bathroom with an office and a game room for the same price as you can get a single family, like three bedroom, two bathroom home here. So I think it's definitely a big concern for me. I do agree that Kamala has more opinions when it comes to housing. I haven't heard much from Trump when it comes to housing, but yeah.
So on those subjects, either of you want to say anything about that? Okay, you don't have to. I'm just here, go ahead.
I mean, kind of just agreeing with them about the housing costs, and kind of just like pulling together what we were talking before. It's not only that the housing price is increasing, but it's also that the wages are not increasing with that.
Well, that's
and
it,
coming
right.
out as a college student, we know that we're not going to earn the same as someone that has been working out there for a long time. So, you know, having those rents and like figuring out where we want to live and what we want to do after college is really scary in these times.
Aaron wanted to talk a little bit more about inflation, and as we open up the conversation a bit more from just the jobless numbers that we have.
So off air, we were talking about that, you know, and Mark alluded to this earlier on air that, you know, a lot of workers are feeling the pinch. They've been pushed closer and closer and closer to the edge of financial abyss. So they're looking over the edge of this cliff and they see that, you know, job loss, more globalization, you know, they don't have enough savings for emergency expenditures. And Trump appeals to that type of voter because he's talking about making America great again. He's hearkening back to this industrial past. But, you know, that industrial past had enormous investment from the federal government, massive increases in education subsidies that allowed lower and middle income families to go to college, massive investments in infrastructure, pro-union legislation where unions represented a third of the workforce. He's proposing the opposite of this nowadays. And if you look at his platform, even though he's appealing to these disgruntled, rightfully so disgruntled, you know, workers without a college degree who have been really pushed to the edge of this financial cliff, his policies that he's proposing are going to make them far worse off than they are now. He's talking about tariffs. I mean, the number changes speech to speech, 50%, 100%, 30%. That's a tax on consumers, and it's going to start a trade war. So other countries are going to impose tariffs on U.S. products. That's going to decrease our exports and create layoffs in export-intensive industries. He wants to restrict immigration, thinking that the labor market's a zero-sum game. Well, if there's fewer immigrants in our economy, there's more jobs for American workers. Well, that's not how economies work, right? It's not a zero-sum game where less immigrants means more jobs. So you're going to create a labor shortage. A lot of the jobs that immigrants have, undocumented immigrants work in, you know, construction and food service. So you're going to see housing costs and grocery prices go up more if he follows through with his immigration plans. He's talking about having increased, I mean, he wants total control over Federal Reserve and interest rate policy. So if, you know, he wakes up one morning and his approval ratings are lower, well, then cut interest rates and that'll get me back on track. You know, that's what Stalin and Kim Jong-un do. So these are very dangerous policies that will if people thought inflation was bad in 2022 and 2023, you ain't seen nothing yet. It's going to be far worse if we get a Trump presidency and he's able to impose even half of the policies he's discussing.
That was Aaron Pasitti on the Roundtable panel on Friday, November 1st. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. A reminder that on Wednesday, November 6th, WAMC is hosting a post-election panel at the Linda. You can go to WAMC.org to find ticket information. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.